I don't know if it's mere happenstance or divine providence, but it seems like almost every other time I am preaching from the lectionary, there is a text on circumcision. My research up until now has focused on circumcision. So it has taken a great deal of what I consider admirable self-control not to speak to you for 25 minutes on the amazingly interesting rite of circumcision. As some of you know, Jen and I grew up here in Southern Ontario, and our families all live within a relatively short drive of Hamilton. It's awkward that I'm talking about Jen and the kids since they've abandoned me for southern climates, by which I mean Leamington, the sun parlor of Canada. For the past 11 years, we have lived in a number of places, almost all warmer than the sun parlor. First, we were in North Carolina for 5 years so that I could study circumcision, watch college basketball, and eat barbecue. I won't say it was in order of importance. Then we spent 2 years in Saskatchewan, where I taught. And finally, we spent the last 4 years in Missouri, also teaching. Never had I considered growing up that I would end up in North Carolina. Never did I want to live in Saskatchewan. And I'm not sure I could have found Missouri on any map. But for the most part, we loved our adventures and experiences. But nonetheless, when Solomon and Maggie were born, we began to long to return to Ontario. So when a great job opened up here in Hamilton, we were elated at the possibility that we might be able both to pursue my vocation and to live near family again. Moving here last summer was, apart from dealing with the crazy real estate market and the inevitable and tedious paperwork involved in international moves, simply put, a dream come true. Despite the many wanderings of our lives, we could never stop calling Southern Ontario home. When we visited, the smells, sounds, and sights of nature all persistently whispered, "You are home." Even the Tim Hortons and Canadian Tires repeatedly told us that we were back home. We've only been in Hamilton 7 months, but I feel more settled, more at peace here than I did after 5 years in North Carolina or four in St. Louis. Perhaps part of that also comes from sensing that our geographical journeys are coming to an end. We always knew that our time in North Carolina and our time in Saskatchewan would stop. We would have to move on. And as much as we enjoyed St. Louis, we never thought we would be there long term. Here, though, we anticipate, rightly or wrongly, growing old and putting down roots. We are home, and there is something indescribably comfortable and comforting about being home, especially to somebody who is a homebody like me. But when I am confronted by a text like Genesis 12, I confess that I begin to feel rather unsettled all over again. After all, the trajectory of our story is the exact opposite of the story of Abraham, who God called to leave family, friends, and home. We may have left for 10 years, but we got to come home. I not only hit the academic jackpot by landing a permanent position at a time when so many accomplished and deserving academics have not, I hit the jackpot again by being able to live exactly where we wanted to live, near family and friends and everything that is familiar, and away from the nightmare that is starting to grow in the States now. Not that far away, unfortunately. Our lives are so comfortable, so good, so easy that I am not sure how to reconcile that fact with accounts such as the story of Abraham. For Jews, Christians, and Muslims, the figure of Abraham plays a central role in the formation of our various religious identities. But if he plays such a central role for religious identity, then we need to think not only about the ways in which our own lives echo his, but also the ways in which our own lives drown out the voice of his life. Two of our lectionary passages for this second Sunday of Lent, Genesis 12 and Romans 4, focus on the person of Abraham. In what ways do these texts affirm the shape of our lives? In what ways do they challenge us? In what ways do they comfort us? And in what ways should they unsettle us? When it comes to Genesis 12, we are faced with a problem, since we simply know next to nothing about Abraham from this chapter. Why does God call this particular man and not someone else? Such a gap in the story begs to be filled in, and later interpreters did just this. For instance, an ancient Jewish rewriting of Genesis, known as the Book of Jubilees from the 2nd century BCE. I wouldn't talk about circumcision, but I will bore you with other details of my research. Claims that even as a teenager, Abraham began to understand, and I quote, that everyone went astray after graven images and after pollution, and he separated from his father so that he might not worship the idols with him. And he began to pray to the creator of all so that he might save him from the strain of humans and so that his portion might not fall into strain after pollution and scorn. Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, makes similar claims. Abraham began to have more lofty conceptions of virtue than the rest of humanity, Josephus claims, and determined to reform and change the ideas universally current concerning God. He was thus first the boldly to declare that God, the creator of the universe, is one. This was a common Jewish view of Abraham. He was the first monotheist. He rejected idolatry and worshiped the one true God. And as a result, God called him to leave his family and to travel to the land of promise. Other Jews portrayed Abraham's burgeoning monotheism in much more colorful ways. One of mine comes from a first century work known as The Apocalypse of Abraham. This tale: one day, Abraham's father made a fire from the scrap wood that came off of a piece of wood that he was carving into an idol. He then instructed Abraham to make his dinner over the fire. Abraham left to prepare some food and placed one of the newly carved idols in front of the fire, saying, Beresat, the name of the idol, watch that the fire does not go out before I come back. If the fire goes out, blow on it so it flares up. And then Abraham left. And when he returned, he saw that the idol had actually tipped over and its feet were in the fire, keeping the fire going. Upon seeing this, Abraham laughed and mocked the god, saying, truly, you know how to light a fire and cook food. And when the food was ready, Abraham carried it to his father, again mocking this god. What kind of god is it that burns up in the fire? We see similar details in Islamic traditions about Abraham. Here, and probably dependent upon earlier Jewish tales, these traditions portrayed Abraham's family as involved in the business of not only worshiping idols, but, heaven forfend, even making them. Despite recognizing the folly of such idolatry, the young Abraham must contribute to the family business by going to the marketplace in order to sell the family wares. Unfortunately for his family, Abraham is too honest to make a good salesman. His sales pitches included such catchy jingles as the following: who will buy my idols? They will not help you, and they cannot hurt you. Who will buy my idols? In one of his gimmicks designed to attract people in the marketplace for a new idol was to drag idols to the edge of a river, dunk their heads in the water, beseeching them to drink. Needless to say, his father soonly relieved him of his duties as a salesman. He must not have been working on a commission. These colorful tales stress that Abraham had recognized that humanity was mired in senseless idol worship, and that the supreme God could not be represented by humans. It is such an admirable wisdom that, according to these traditions, preceded God's call of Abraham. In other words, such stories explain and make sense out of the silence of Genesis 12. Why did God call Abraham and not someone else? Because Abraham recognized the one true God in ways that others did not. While these stories might explain what seems inexplicable, and while they certainly entertain, they diverge from the narrative of Genesis. When we hear of God's calling in Genesis 12, we only know a few key details. This is what we learn about Abraham from Genesis 11, 27 through 30. It states, "Now these are the descendants of Terah. Terah was the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran was the father of Lot. Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. Now Sarai was barren, she had no child." According to Genesis, then, nothing Abraham does precedes God's call on his life. In fact, one might even suggest that God's call could not be directed to someone more unlikely. In Genesis 12, God says to Abraham, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing." Given what little we know about Abraham, God's choice is not merely inexplicable, it's downright absurd. Why call a man who has no children and whose wife is incapable of having children? What kind of nation can one make from these two people? How can God make Abraham's name great when he will have no offspring who can remember his name? Why not at least choose someone who is reproductively prolific? In addition to the silence around the question of why God chooses this particular man and his wife Sarah, the text is circumspect in dealing with Abraham's response. To be sure, we hear that he takes his family and follows God's call, but the narrator leaves us wondering about Abraham's inner thoughts and emotions. As someone who has recently returned from wandering in a foreign country, I can't help but think about the difficulty of leaving family and friends in order to follow a bodiless voice commanding you to go to an undefined land. Yet Abraham trusts this voice at least enough to follow. Well, how about Sarah? No doubt she had very little say in the matter, but what were her thoughts? After all, she didn't even get the benefit of hearing the voice that Abraham did. Was she supposed to blindly trust her husband, who was 10 years older than her and getting on in years? The call of Abraham and the subsequent birth of the nation of Israel stresses the fact that God calls and creates this nation out of nothing. Integral to the ancestral narratives of Israel found in Genesis is the theme of the infertility of Israel's ancestors. Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Rachel. For each couple, it is God who eventually opens the womb and brings life, so to speak, out of death. It is this very theme that the Apostle Paul emphasizes in his retelling of Abraham and Sarah's story in Romans 4. Combining Genesis 15 and 18, Paul states that when God promises Abraham offspring, Abraham did not doubt, despite the fact that his body was already as good as dead, for he was about 100 years old, and despite the fact that Sarah's womb was barren. Why? Because this is the God, Paul observes in 4:17, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. The creator God of Genesis 1, then, is the God who takes the primordial darkness and waters of chaos and calls into existence an ordered world in which life can flourish. This God is in the habit of bringing life out of death. In creation, in good as dead bodies of Abraham and Sarah, and Paul goes on to argue in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. This God has a compulsion to take nothing and to create something good and whole and wonderful. Paul claims in Romans 4:20 that no just distrust made Abraham waver concerning the promise of God, but he grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, being fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. Any reading of Genesis 12 through 25 would indicate that Paul has simplified at best and falsified at worst the portrayal of Abraham. Throughout Genesis, Abraham appears to vacillate between unquestioning faith, leaving his family and home, or willingly offering up Isaac on an altar, and rational doubts, challenging God's promises in Genesis 15 because he remains childless, deceiving others about his marriage to Sarah, getting Hagar pregnant as a way of navigating around Sarah's barrenness. Those vacillations in Genesis comfort me, because Abraham's doubts are my doubts. The same dangers, or at least related dangers and threats that faced Abraham persist to this day. And for that matter, God still acts in the slow and mysterious way that he did with Abraham. Abraham and Sarah, after all, left home years before the birth of Isaac. And even at the end of their lives, their family was small and inconsequential. And even though they traveled the land God promised them, they were little more than undocumented aliens in that land, always at the mercy of the ruling powers that threatened to expel or kill them. God may not call us to the literal abandonment of family, friends, and home, but the same barrenness, hopelessness, and death that challenged Abraham and Sarah challenges us. Perhaps it is the barrenness of a current job situation, or the hopelessness of our financial situation, or the death of a marriage or a relationship. Or perhaps it is the barrenness and hopelessness of our own inner lives, our own lack of faith, our own emptiness. Whatever barrenness we endure, we are constantly tempted to capitulate either to denial or to cynicism. Lent is that time of year when we name our barrenness, when we confess our hopelessness, when we admit our mortality, our weakness, our limitations. We are dust. In the wilderness of Lent, we'd look death in the face, our own deaths, relational, economic, political, bodily deaths, not because we aren't afraid, but because we believe imperfectly and weakly that these deaths are not the final word. In the wilderness of Lent, we, like Abraham, acknowledge our own sins, our own frailties, and our own mortality. But we also proclaim our hope that the same God who can call into the darkness and bring forth light, the same God who can call into the tomb and call forth and raise Jesus from the dead, can raise us, our lives, our relationships, our dreams, and our world out of the dark and chaotic forces that threaten to overwhelm. Amen.